This week's episode of Undisclosed is brought to you by Stamps.com. Mailing and shipping can seem like a no-win situation. The post office can take forever. And postage meter is kind of expensive. Fortunately, there's a better way. Stamps.com. With Stamps.com, you can buy and print official U.S. postage for any letter or package using your own printer and computer right from the comfort of your own home. Right now, if you sign up for Stamps.com and use my promo code Undisclosed for the special offer, you will get a 4-week trial and $110 in bonus offers, including postage and a digital scale. So don't wait. Go to stamps.com before you do anything else. Click on the microphone at the top of the homepage and type in undisclosed. That's stamps.com and enter undisclosed. This week's episode is also brought to you by The Great Courses. Now, as we all know, learning doesn't stop after we finish school. That's why I love The Great Courses, a really engaging video and audio lecture series. Now, if you know anything about me or you follow me on social media, you know that I am all about food, and I cook a lot. I'm a pretty prolific and proficient home cook, I must say, but I am no gourmet. That's why I really enjoyed watching the Everyday Gourmet cooking collection from The Great Courses, which includes The Essential Secrets of Spices in Cooking, Making Healthy Food Taste Great, Baking Pastries and Desserts, and Making Great Meals in Less Time. It was filmed in partnership with the CIA, which is the Culinary Institute of America, and these lecture series offer tools and tips from a master chef to enhance your cooking skills. Now, The Great Courses is celebrating their 25th anniversary. They've got over 500 courses on lots of different subjects, and I really want you to give them a shot. So, for a limited time, The Great Courses has a special offer for Undisclosed listeners. You can order any one of these four The Everyday Gourmet courses for just $9.95. This $9.95 price is only available for a limited time, so order today. Go to thegreatcourses.com/undisclosed. Again, that's thegreatcourses.com/undisclosed. Hi, and welcome to episode 12 of Undisclosed, Prisoner's Dilemma. My name is Rabia Chaudhary. I'm an attorney and national security fellow, and I blog at splitthemoon.com. And I'm joined with my colleague Susan Simpson, who's an associate at the Vocal Law Group in Washington, D.C., and she blogs at The View from LL2. Now, it's been just over a year since Serial began, and over 6 months since Undisclosed started. In this time, hundreds and hundreds of articles have been written about the podcast and about the case itself. We've heard from so many different perspectives. Lawyers, investigators, police, journalists, professors, students, bloggers, activists. It's been overwhelming how many people feel compelled by the case. But one perspective we haven't heard from are people who have experienced the criminal justice system firsthand. I'm talking about convicted and incarcerated people. For the record, I try and avoid using labels like inmate and convict and instead prefer to use the term incarcerated or convicted people, because we often do forget that they are people. If you've been following us for the past couple of weeks, you'll remember that we were hoping to release this episode late last week after there was a delay in getting clearance on a portion of the interview. It wasn't until the very end of the week that we were told that, unfortunately, permission was denied. But luckily, we do have part of the interview with us, and Susan and I then get to speak at length with the remarkable woman who helped make this all happen.
A few months back, I read an article called The One Perspective on Serial You Haven't Heard, What Prisoners Think. It's a great article. You should check it out on Medium. And after I read it, I got in touch with the author, Kendra Hovey. Kendra volunteers at the Marion Correctional Institute in Ohio, where she volunteers through a group called Healing Broken Circles. The inmates there at Marion Correctional had been listening to Serial through prison programming, and when Kendra found out, she decided to talk to them about Serial and their thoughts on it, and wrote an article. After I read it, I got in touch with her and found out that the prisoners there had started to listen to Undisclosed. So I asked her if it might be possible for her to talk to them again, only this time about Undisclosed, and to record it for the podcast. So she talked to the prison, and they were on board with it. So she got a group of prisoners together, and after listening to episodes 1-8, they had a discussion on their thoughts about Undisclosed. Could you tell us a bit about how you got involved with the Marion Correctional Institute and what your role there is?
Well, how I got involved was kind of accidentally and reluctantly. I had the opportunity to attend an event at Marion Correctional It was they did one of the first, actually the first TEDx event in a prison, in an adult prison, and I got an invitation to go to this, and essentially I felt like if I'm any kind of curious person, I'll go and take this opportunity. And this was over 3 years ago. Nobody was talking really about criminal justice at that time. But I went, and I was blown away. It was really interesting. It was really fun. I had to confront, you know, a lot of assumptions I didn't know I had about prisons and prisoners. And basically, I just kept going back to more of these events. You know, I'm a writer and journalist, and was just drawn to this story, and I've been going and interviewing the guys, you know, for the last year or so, more frequently. And when I found out they were listening to Serial, we had a conversation about that.
I mean, we first got in contact after I read your article on prisoners on Serial. I got in touch with you and asked if we'd possibly do a Prisoners on Undisclosed episode. And I was surprised that you were kind of enthusiastic about it, because I assumed that just for, you know, reasons of bureaucracy in the prison, it wouldn't be an option. But your institution has been willing to work with you on this, which I was impressed by.
Yeah, well, so Marion is part of the Ohio Department of Rehabilitation and Corrections, and Ohio is one of very few states that have retained the word rehabilitation in their title. They consider it central to their mission. Essentially, you know, most people in prison will be released from prison into our communities, and ODRC wants the people who come out of their prisons to be people we would welcome into our communities as our neighbors, our employees, our friends. And I've heard the term they use is community corrections, and they believe outside connections. Well, we know that outside connections are essential to successful reentry. A lot of people think of that in terms of family and friends. But they think of it also in terms of community. We think of our hospitals and our schools as part of our community. Do we think of our prisons as part of our community? I certainly didn't, but I have to say I do now. And what I've seen specifically at Marion is an emphasis not just on programming, but good quality programming for the entire human being. So it's more than just an accumulation of skills. There's a nonprofit, Healing Broken Circles, which the guys, you'll hear the guys mention it. It's a physical space. They have a physical space called Lifeline inside Marion, where there's like just tons to learn and be involved in. And there's this, it's like a prison specific pedagogy, you know, that seems to just be very successful. And that they helped, create they're part of the TEDx in prison, movement. But Healing Broken Circles, Jody Davis, I have to mention, is the executive director. If I could nominate her for MacArthur Junior Genius Grant, I would. They're doing, from what I can see, it looks like, you know, prison reform from within. But with Healing Broken Circles, everyone is treated with respect and dignity. That sounds really simple, but it's just not the norm for American prisons. Everyone is eligible. All prisoners are eligible for the programming, which also sounds simple, but it's very typical in prison for programming to be limited to those within 5 years of release or potential release, which leaves a whole lot of people with absolutely nothing to do, and really has no impact on the prison culture. But when education and skill building and involvement is not limited, it's able to have a really positive effect on the entire prison culture. Healing Broken Circles' approach is strength-based, so they build on what a person is good at. Quite often when people mess up, it's like their worst moment or their weakness, the shortcoming that we think that they should focus on. But at Healing Broken Circles is more about helping people be whole again. And that's where they get their name.
I was telling you earlier about how I was very impressed with some of the comments that the prisoners made. And I couldn't tell how much of that was just me being prejudiced and being, you know, surprised that a prisoner would be so insightful, and how much is just, you know, genuinely appreciating their comments. So it's for me, it was also kind of probably one of the first times I've really confronted my prejudices of what a prisoner should sound like.
Yeah. And I think a lot of people confronted that a little bit when they heard Adnan's voice, you know, in Serial.
But it's easy to assume he's like one of the kind, it's a neat story.
Right. But when I listen to Serial and I listen to Adnan's voice very differently, I think, than a lot of people, because I've been in conversation, you know, with guys who are in prison and some women who are in prison, you know, for quite a while now. And to me, he sounded like a lot of the guys I talked to, like that sort of self-possession, that thoughtfulness, the maturity. Like, it's not unusual. I know people will not believe me. I mean, the guys, one of the things that came up in the conversation is the guys really identified with Adnan. And these guys are guilty, you know, and they will say, I am guilty. But Adnan and these guys are the same thing, right? They are prisoners, right? Adnan just happens, is a prisoner, is unlike the other prisoners in that he's a prisoner who probably was never a criminal. But these people come into prison as criminals, but then a prisoner is what you become when you live in a prison for months, years, decades. You may die there, but there is this, you know, prisoner that we know absolutely nothing about. You know, we just shove them away, stick them on the shelf. It's like they don't exist. It's like they're in stasis or something. Because there's partly, you know, we can't know what's going on, because that's the whole idea of prison is there, those walls are so we can't see in. But we also don't really want to see in. And then, you know, we just project on them all our assumptions and fears, TV, media. And so it's shocking when you know, a caricature or a cardboard cutout just becomes a real person. And, you know, that I assume that people do think that Adnan is somehow special. I'm sure he's special, you know, to Rabia, you know, to his loved ones. I'm sure he's a special person, but he doesn't sound that different to me than a lot of the guys that I've talked to who are in prison and were once criminals and who admit, you know, that they are guilty of their crime.
It's worth mentioning, like you said earlier, that we don't know much about prisoners because we don't hear their voices, don't hear their experiences. But yeah, it's worth noting that it's helpful, as Marianne has been and things happen and putting things together. And as much as I think it's awesome, they're willing to do it. There have been some holdups. So right now, at the time of recording, we have gotten approval for half of the audio. There's a second half, which we're hoping to have in the episode. It may or may not, because the prison has its own issues to try and juggle.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's a few logistical things. Like, this is highly unusual. And this is, they're really, you know, going out on a limb with this and really pushing things through quickly. So that's something I really appreciate. But also, the institution has a lot of different interests to consider. One, of course, is sensitivity to victims. Another is that they have to consider the prisoners, that things they say could unintentionally backfire on their own lives. I mean, we know that Adnan suffered a consequence for talking to Sarah Koenig. And the assumption is that sort of prison draconian policies, you know, are behind, you know, his limitation on his phone privileges. It might be, I don't know anything about that prison, but I know that sometimes it is us, the public, that is the source of these policies. I mean, like, whoever calls a prison and says, I really appreciate you honoring an inmate's right to have a voice. I really like that you support prisoners learning through free educational software like Khan Academy or Audacity. No one does that, but people will write in to say, what are you doing? Prisoners don't deserve to have a voice. They don't deserve education. They should all be rotting in hell.
There was a case not too long ago that, for me, was completely shocking. I had no idea this happened. But it was where the phone company that handled the prisoners' phone calls, they had a contract that gave them copyright over any conversations that happened.
Yeah.
So when someone was recording conversation in connection with this guy's case with the prisoner, they found out, and because he was violating the copyright of the phone company, they punished him.
Yeah.
I believe went into the shoe for that.
Yeah. This conversation on criminal justice, you know, has exploded. But the only prisoners we can bring ourselves to talk about are nonviolent drug offenders. And most incarcerated just don't meet this qualification. And so we erase them from the conversation, which is how prisons are able to mistreat them. While everyone is rallying around Adnan, I mean, that's an anomaly. Usually people want people who are in prison to stay in prison.
So we'll start out by just setting the scene. We're inside Marion Correctional, a medium security state prison in Ohio, part of the Ohio Department of Rehabilitation and Corrections. Population in this prison is 2,600. In this room are 8 members of that population and myself. This is the second time we are gathering together. We first met back in April after you had just heard the Serial podcast. And now you have heard up to episode 8 of Undisclosed. And so we're gathered again to have a discussion about the Undisclosed podcast. Anyone listening might find this to be an unusual situation. First of all, that prisoners would be listening to podcasts. Prisoners don't have access to the internet. They cannot download podcasts. So does somebody want to take that and explain how it is that you've been able to listen to Serial and Undisclosed thus far?
Sure. This is Wayne. So at this prison, Marion Correctional, it's a rather progressive prison. The warden that we have now, Jason, it's our third warden in a row that has really pushed progressive programming at this facility. And there's an outside entity, Healing Broken Circles, that provides one of the program providers in the institution. And some of their contractors have been able to download those for us and bring them in. Most prisons have a TV network or a channel where they just show just movies. It's just for entertainment value, just to pacify. But we were able to get a second channel. We call it our TED channel because it mostly shows TED Talks. But we also show documentaries and things like podcasts, things that are more educational and informative than just entertainment.
And another thing people might find unusual is that I'm even here. Usually people like me aren't allowed to come in and sit down and have a conversation with a bunch of prisoners. Why are we able to do this?
This is Dan. I think that continues on with Marion's progressive attitude, and it's really in an effort to develop the whole human being. It's a holistic approach. So having conversations with outside guests or having a way of dialogue to transfer information back and forth to really get to know other people besides the guys you're locked up with every day helps you broaden your horizons. It also helps get us used to talking to outside folks, because some of us have been locked down 20 plus years and you've only talked to other dudes the whole time. So one of the things that's been really exciting about Marion is the ability to go to different events inside the place and talk to people. And it's probably why Ohio and Marion specifically has one of the lowest recidivism rates in the country.
All right, so let's do introductions. Each of us can share our name and quickly say what brings us to this discussion.
Okay, I'm Wayne. My actual institutional job is working for that outside organization, Healing Broken Circles. My job entails providing programming, and through that job, came across Serial, and our contractor was nice enough to get it and bring it in, and I've just been overjoyed to be able to bring this kind of entertainment and information to my fellow offenders.
My name is Khalid. I'm an inmate here at MCI. What got me interested in participating in this group is because of my involvement with the law on a higher level and a lower level of justice system.
This is Ty, and I found Serial relatable, and I thought the first discussion that we had in April was interesting, so I was glad I was invited back.
My name is Ryan. Pretty much the same thing as Todd here. It's just I related to a lot of stuff that I heard during the first discussion and wanted to see how the second discussion went.
Scotty, I work in Healing Broken Circles. And when I played them over the network, I watched them before then. And so when Wayne and Dan were creating or getting the new ones and listening to the new ones, I was like, hey, is there some of the new episodes? He was like, yes. Not only that, they were getting made it for a podcast. So I got in that one.
So this is Dan. I'm Wayne's partner in crime. We have been working with stuff like this for a couple years, and it was enthralled by Serial. Like, captured me. It was great storytelling, maybe Sarah's voice, I don't know, a little bit of everything, but I really enjoyed listening to the Serial podcast because it was odd that something like this was getting so much attention when it's something we see all the time, and behind these walls we hear these stories. But it was great to see it was getting attention nationwide, and then Undisclosed just took it to an H&L, a whole nother level. I mean, it was really eye-opening to watch that. It was shocking. I really enjoyed the way they presented the material, so I enjoy having conversations like this with my dudes.
I'm Will. I am in programming for software development and architecture.
So I see Dan and Wayne a lot, and they actually told me that they were planning on putting it on the TED channel, which I spend a lot of my time when I'm not actually in class watching, because I enjoy getting to learn new things. It's one of the things that helps to keep me motivated to try to help get to a better spot before I leave.
My name is Andrew, and I have spent a large part of my life listening to a lot of stuff on public radio, so I enjoyed the whole podcasting situation.
So last we talked, there was a general consensus that Adnan was basically convicted on a story and that his conviction was unfair. Yet, as far as personal feelings of guilt or innocence, there was a mixture. There was a general consensus that that's not really what's important. The room sort of leaned towards innocence, yet there were some that felt he had some involvement. A common thread was, I'm too biased to say, because I'm a prisoner, for one thing. But bias went both towards innocence and guilty, which was interesting. So now that you've listened to 8 episodes of Undisclosed, can we just go around real quick? Just guilty or innocent?
Very innocent.
Second out, very innocent.
Okay, does anybody going to say guilty? No.
I don't think anybody is in this situation.
Well, hold on. I mean, it depends on who we're talking about. Because if we're talking about Adnan, I don't think anybody is.
Adnan.
Somebody
okay.
definitely is.
All right. So,
right? Unless
so,
I'm wrong. Is there anybody who thinks differently, Todd?
This is Todd, and I'm going to say that I don't know, but I would lean towards innocent. There are times when I listen to Undisclosed and then re-listening to Serial, where depending on the day, I kind of went back and forth, but I don't know.
Another thing that people expressed opinions about was Jay. So after listening to Undisclosed through episode 8, Jay, do you think he has any role?
Any role in the Adnan being in prison or any role in Hayes' murder?
Right.
This question is Jay involved in the committing of the crime of Hayes' murder in any way?
I think yes. He has too many. Well, actually, I don't think he has any facts. I'm going to say no. That's how bad Jay is. Jay is so a conundrum. I'm so confused about Jay. It doesn't make sense.
Well, Wayne here, I will say that I agree with Dan in that at this point, you have no idea what Jay knows or didn't know because there's so much shenaniganism with the interviews. Yeah, made up word.
Scott.
However, something still precipitated his involvement. I think there was some level of involvement, but I don't think he did.
He knew about it. Someone he knows did it. Something like that.
Scotty, you resume saying?
I just feel sorry for Jay, because he's just in a bad position. It's like, one moment he's forced to say something, then he's offering something. It's just like, who is this guy? Where did he come from? What is going on with this guy? Is he part of it? Is he just making something up for something? Or it's just real confusing. And then Adnan is just a fall guy in the situation, which is crazy.
This is Ryan. If we're to believe that the police got to him before the initial interview, he may not have any involvement at all and may just have all been a story that they had been focusing on Adnan to begin with and gave him the story before his initial interview, and I'm using air quotes.
So, this is Will. I kind of agree, for the most part, with what everybody says about Jay as well. It doesn't seem that he had much actual information, but the only thing that makes me wonder as to the level of any kind of involvement was when he was supposedly, and I'm talking about what happened when they discussed at Serial, he was supposedly at work, and there was a van parked across from his work, and he was worried about somebody coming to, quote-unquote, get him in connection to this vehicle. And that makes me wonder why, which kind of lends credence to he might have had something to do with it. Even if he's completely oblivious to the world around him, he might have had some connection.
This is Todd. My interest kind of recently has turned towards Jay and Jen. I would really be interested to have them take a real hard, long look at Jay and Jen collectively.
Yeah, Jen as a whole, she's like the most interesting figure in this thing, because I think Jay was protecting her, but then it takes a whole other speculation, and I feel like Jay at that point. I'm just making shit up, so I'm not even going down the Jen rabbit hole, but she's very interesting at this point.
Yeah. And this is Khalid. I think Jay has somewhat involvement, but his involvement doesn't match up to what he says. I believe he's saying things to protect another individual who hasn't been mentioned much in this. Jen is very involved, but there's another party that I would like to have looked into further, because there was a call made to this guy and they just disregarded, and he was a contributing factor of what their plan was as far as getting hooked up with marijuana and this and that. There was another person's name that was involved.
Was this person mentioned in Serial or in Undisclosed?
Pete.
Oh, Pete.
Yeah. It did seem like his actions were to protect somebody, and specifically to protect Jen. And maybe Hayes stumbled on to the two of them and found out some information that they didn't want to get out, or something along those lines, because that kind of dynamic seems to play out with a lot of what they're doing.
And I think, Wayne, you had made the point in our earlier discussion that Jay was driving Adnan's car. So that's a connection point. Hay could have thought that Adnan was in the car and somehow approached Jay at the wrong time. Or
she sees the car, pulls up next to him, and they're in the middle of a drug deal or the middle of God knows what, or she follows them somewhere and sees something she's not supposed to see. There's a lot of possibilities that just were never explored.
So something that also came up in the Serial discussion was, while many of us listening on the outside were shocked by what we found out about how this system runs, our criminal justice system, how an investigation is done, one of the first things a lot of you guys said was, same old, same old. We know this story. This is not a unique story. Now you've listened to Undisclosed. Is it same old, same old? Are you feeling shock? Are you feeling surprise?
This is Ryan. My whole thing is, once you go through the justice system, you realize why nonfiction writers are so popular writing court and dramas, is because it's just one big story. Everything's always a story, and that's what the prosecution does, is they try to build a story around them. And so everything's a story, and they add and take out and move stuff around to fit their story. And I think it's probably happened in 99.9% of all cases taken to trial. There's never the true, it happened like this, 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 and this, and there's no story. That's what it is. It's a story. Everything.
This is Will. It interests me that it's actually been written about back during the Nuremberg trials. I can't remember her last name, Anne something or other, mentioned that it was like a theater. And that's what most of the court cases tend to be. It's more for almost like entertainment, that there's either a prescribed story that has already been determined and it's just playing out, or they're doing it for...
I mean, that's great, right? That's great. Okay, it's fine. Courts theater is why it makes great TV shows, courtroom dramas. Forget court. Then the prosecutors, the detectives on this case created a story. I mean, that's what shocked me. So I was used to there being a certain level of investigative liberties, right, taken. I've seen NYPD Blue. I've been part of the justice system. I've heard stories my whole bit. But then to hear them knocking on the table, to hear Jay's story change, I always wondered, why does Jay's story keep on changing? It was changing because the facts he was being fed kept on changing. You know, so that's why Jay's confusing to me. But that was shocking, even to me, and I'm a cynical, jaded bastard, but that was like, what, really? They're really doing this? I was blowing my mind. I was reading the transcripts first. I read the transcripts to almost all the episodes before we listened to them. And as I'm reading the transcripts for, was it four? Were the knocking? Or six?
Two or four.
Somewhere around there. It was, I think it was four. I was reading it, and I was like, I got to hear this. There's no way there's really knocking in the background like that. And then it was clear as day. So Susan or whoever heard that while I listened to him, like, no wonder Jay's story didn't change. So did that shock anybody else? Like, we understand prosecutorial misconduct. We hear about that all the time. But the police at the very beginning?
Yeah, this is Andrew. Yeah, the amount of the issues in this case are so amazing to me. It's not that we all, like I said, we all know that a lot of things happen, but they just did everything they could to possibly say, hey, this is our guy, we like him, and we're going to make this happen regardless.
You can't say they're bad detectives, Dan, again, because they worked really hard to get the story straight. So it wasn't like they were like accidentally messing your life up. They were working really, really, really hard.
They were good at it.
They were good at it.
Very good at it.
They were good at being
in that. This is not the first time they've done it.
They were good at
it. Scotty, what do you think?
I mean, they worked so hard to even make mistakes to the point where
they make a whole story about a cell phone ping that didn't exist because they looked at the map wrong. Remember that part?
Yeah.
I mean, it's just crazy. So I was just like flabbergasted at how they would, certain things that you're supposed to do as detectives that they didn't do. Like when they were first at the scene, they found rope and things of that nature and didn't even take it into evidence. So it's just like, they had it out for a nine the whole time. So it's just like,
so
wow.
Do you guys have any insights into whatever we want to call it, that certain kind of tunnel vision?
This is Khalid. I would say that sometimes it's a thing called statistics, they say. They have a certain amount of cases so high up on scale that they haven't solved. And what they do sometimes is that they figure, well, if we put this one case out on publicity, put it in open, let media eat it up and all this, and we solve this case, it makes it look like we're doing our job. So in pertaining to Adan's, this situation with him, is they say, well, she was a popular girl in high school. She was well-liked in the community. She had a good future coming along, and someone took it from her. And now what we want to do is look like we're the hero. So all these other cases and all these other bodies we found in the same park, well, maybe they are not paid so much attention to them, and will get promoted to chief or whatever it is may be done. If long we solve this one case, it doesn't matter how we get it solved, as long as we solve it.
And then you got all these TV, Scotty, you got all these TV shows that are influential to people's conscious decisions. You got, like you said, you got the girl that's in high school and just broke up with a boyfriend, so let's look at him.
This is Todd. I think the thing that really still sticks to me is like the loss, that Adnan's lost so many, and you can debate the guilt or the innocent, but that Adnan's lost, 15, maybe 16 years of his life now. And then also, kind of going with, and I don't necessarily know that they're relatable, but how does a detective or a prosecutor push forward when, as we've kind of talked about, there looks like there's some holes. And does he ever question his belief that Adnan was guilty? Say, well, maybe he didn't do it, or maybe he, and then, but still push forward. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I guess that's the tunnel vision part. It's very confusing, and it's also hard to digest.
Yeah.
This is Ryan. When does it become habit for detectives who have done this before and then continue to do it? It just becomes second nature to kind of do this to people, that they don't use their investigative skills maybe that they used 10 years ago when they first started, and they. It's kind of like maybe taking money and being on the take. You take it the first time, and then you go continue to do it. Maybe this is the same thing. You do it the first time, and it was easy, and we got the murder off the books, and then we do it again, and then again, and then again, and before long, it just becomes second nature.
Yeah, because this isn't McGill. This is Dan. This isn't McGillivary's first, or isn't the only case he's involved in. That's, I think, yeah, names, there's a lot of names, but I'm pretty sure it's not his first time he's involved in a case. It's somewhat questionable on the way it was investigated. So that's understandable. But I think that it's kind of like now we have cops that are just killing people in the middle of the streets, right? And it's not every cop. It's just becoming somewhat commonplace because we're seeing it a lot. And then you have to like drop down a level. There's probably some cops who are doing like McGillivary is doing. They're just adjusting the facts a little bit to make sure they get the guy they know who did it. That is gut intuition. And then you have the cops who are actually doing their job. So you have this different, this gradation of, just like you have with us. We have dudes who probably should never get out of prison, right? There's some true, live, cold-blooded killers. And then you have guys like me who've done way too long in prison. And you know what I mean? There's guys like you who tripped and fell into prison. You know what I mean? I'm just saying that's a general rule. So you have like different levels of, of guys on the criminal side, just like you do on the cop side. So I don't want to paint all cops like this, but it's becoming kind of, if they're killing guys in the street, what the next level down has to be so big. You know what I mean? To hold that pyramid up, the next level of corruption or the next lower level of corruption has to be so big.
This is Will. The one thing that stands out to me is that we as a society, and typically singularly, tend to put these people on a pedestal that we have to keep in mind that any one of us in a job has decided to cut corners. If you're pushing a broom, you've decided, I'm not going to sweep that corner because it doesn't look that bad. They're going to do the same things. I got pressure from my boss to get my job done so that I can keep my job, so that I can get a promotion, so that I don't get fired for whatever reason. And all of these are going to be determining factors in anything that I do on my job. It just so happens that this weight on people's lives and not just pushing some paperwork around.
Wayne here. The bit that I would add to that is, and they did an episode in Serial Undisclosed about confirmation bias, and I think they should have explored that a whole lot more, because that just comes down to human nature. Like, one, cutting corners is human nature. That's just, we find the path of least resistance. But confirmation bias comes in when, I mean, it doesn't take a genius to look at the ex-boyfriend, right? So once you have that in your head, unconscious bias, just that's the tunnel vision. That's what tunnel vision is. I mean, short of God parting the clouds and saying, stop looking at him, look in this direction, every piece of evidence that you get that might point in that direction, you get it. And anything, DNA evidence, videotape, nothing matters if it doesn't fit your preconceived notion. And that's not nefarious. That's not a corrupt cop. It's human nature. It's the way we are wired.
Yeah, it's either proves or disproves my theory. If it disproves it, I don't need that's
funny,
not what I'm looking for.
Sorry. It's funny you say that. This is Will. Because I was just thinking as he was talking about it, that's actually rife in the scientific community. There are so many theories, and people are strict adherents to a certain theory, string theory, standard theory, whatever. And they will just completely disregard any evidence that goes against whatever it is they hold. So, it's everywhere.
Yeah, like I said, confirmation bias, human nature, definitely. Yeah.
If there's any group of people that's boxed in by a label, it's you guys, like prisoner. I think what a lot of listeners hearing Undisclosed are having trouble reconciling that the cops and the prosecutors could do this kind of stuff. There's a tendency maybe to think of them in terms of bad guys, you know, so you guys are generalized as bad guys. And what I'm hearing you say, you're not saying cops are bad guys. You're talking about systems they're vulnerable to.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely. This is Dan. Definitely, they're not only are they not bad guys, some of them, there's probably some nefarious practices, just like there are with us, that you are going to have that. But you also have the machine that is the criminal justice system. And they're just another cog in that machine. That the end product is assuaging a parent or a family who suffered loss or has something happen to them, is assuaging them, dealing justice, and getting a news bite on the thing. And the bad part of that is it ends up with one of us or someone like me in prison. The machine spits out inmates, and they're just there to do it.
Right.
You know, so they're caught up in everyday life and just getting eaten up by that same machine.
This is Todd. I think kind of going with this too is I think the machine or the job, whatever part of the system that you're in, I don't think that your responsibility, your job, whatever role you play allows you to kind of step out of your role or step out of that situation and maybe kind of turn around and look at the situation from a different angle, because, you know, everybody's kind of moving whatever your job is, you're moving in one direction. It's like the kid that gets beat up at school all the time. Or gets made fun of. No one ever says, like, why does everybody always beat him up, you know? And then all of a sudden, maybe someone does, but the system is already rolling in one direction, and no one listens to the one person. You know, prosecutors don't come in 10, 15, 20 years later and look at the offender and say, I think he's rehabilitated, or he's done this, or let's take a look at the individual. You know, they were 18, they're 40 now, whatever. And, you know, kind of reevaluate them. What they say is, this is what he did, this is who he is, and this is who will always be. So then, therefore, I think that's how you kind of just get caught up in the system.
This is Andrew. I've had friends who, because they saw my situation, they decided that they were going to be defense attorneys. And they went to school for that because they were like, if they can treat you this way, they can treat anybody like that, and shine a light on the system for them. Which a lot of people, if you're not in it or a part of it, you don't know what's happening.
So, unfortunately, it turns out that we did not get approval for the last half of the audio from the prisoner's conversation. The prison spent some time making it over and eventually gave us a final note. Not going to approve it. We can't use it. So, we do not have the last half for you, which is unfortunate because, in many respects, I think it was the better half, and the prisoners had some great conversations. But we can tell you a little bit about what happened and about why the prison decided against letting us share it with you.
First of all, I'd like to say I do apologize. And I will apologize again because I wish I could give you a satisfactory answer, and I'm hoping to be able to do that eventually still. I can tell you that a majority of the audio was approved, you know, at Marion Correctional, but there were some questions, so it needed to go up the chain to ODRC's administrative offices. My hope is simply that something got lost or misunderstood along its journey. There's no precedent for a podcast. You know, not everyone is even familiar with the podcast medium, and I know that there were some technical issues also with transferring the file. A point person was out of town. It's just Prisoners on a Podcast has never been done before. You know, add in all these complications, and maybe it's just going to take a little more time and understanding. So my hope is that it will still be approved, or at least part of it. And if not, I hope I can bring more clarity to the reason why. There were certainly parts of the conversation that I think strayed from the guidelines. It was a free form conversation. The 19 minutes is very much like what you've heard already, but there could be concerns within it that I'm unaware of.
What can you share with us about what the prisoners discussed in the second half of your conversation with them?
Yeah, so like I said, it was a fairly free form conversation with the guys sharing their thoughts from their unique perspective about Serial and Undisclosed and the case, against Adnan. And what resonated with them and the current concerns, what concerned them as they were listening to it would be, fascinating for people to hear, I think, and very surprising. Just to summarize a little, one thing they brought up was how painful this must be for Heyman Lee's family. They talked extensively about whether their family will ever get justice. At one point, one man, brought up that though it's clearly problematic, he asked, what about this crowdsourcing of murder investigations? And he made a point that I hadn't really thought of, that the detectives in 1999 kind of did this anyway, by sort of pseudo deputizing the teachers at Woodlawn.
And that's a great point, because it wasn't just the teachers either. They also outsourced their expert functions, like with the forensic anthropologist they brought in from Washington.
Right.
And don't forget, the INEHE group, right? Manny Johnson. And she also helped with the investigation early on.
Yes. They also talked about how quickly and easily we assume guilt, and that this certainly happened to Adnan. But then just immediately they questioned their own selves and how they do that too. There's just no blame or judgment, towards, and I think this would surprise people, towards people's assumptions about criminals and prisoners, people, they're towards the cops even.
Can I ask you a question about that, Kendra?
Sure.
You said that they questioned even themselves on making those presumptions of guilt. Are you saying that they tend to do that with other inmates as well, just jump to this conclusion before getting to know the person or hearing the story?
Sure. I mean, they basically said it's just this kind of human reaction. So, they see someone going to the hole and they're like, oh, he must have done something wrong. Or they had another example, like, someone's coming back from county and, through their head, it'll run, oh, he's a snitch. So they talked about their own knee-jerk responses, and that it's really a human thing, and that you have to, make an effort to counter those sort of automatic assumptions.
And it's basically exactly what Debbie said in her interview with the cops. They asked her, do you think he's guilty? And she's like, yeah. And they ask her why. And she says, well, you wouldn't have arrested him for no reason.
Right.
And that's it.
Yeah.
I was going to say that that also was the sentiment in the community to a certain extent, but not so much until he was convicted. Once he was convicted, people thought, because most people didn't attend the trial, and they didn't know why he was convicted. Most of his peers, the students at the school and the community were like, well, they definitely got him. There's had to be something there. A jury of your peers doesn't do that unless there's something there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the guys definitely talked about that. I mean, these guys, though, are guilty. And kind of what they talked about is, not so much in this conversation, but I would say in our earlier conversation, was all the assumptions around the kind of person they could be to do what they did, their character, their whole family being demonized because of their action, which is our approach to criminal, our understanding of criminal activity has really been influenced by this idea of the sort of permanent criminal personality. And of course, Sarah Koenig goes there in Serial, that murder is in the DNA. Whereas there's a possibility that it's an action, not a personality.
I know when we finally got the denial from the prison, I was surprised because obviously you talked to the prison ahead of time, got approval, and it seemed like everyone was on board. And from what I knew of the conversation that you'd had, there didn't seem anything objectionable. The way you put it is that it seemed pretty humanizing of them, in fact. It just showed a very normal human conversation with nothing that, for me, would have triggered bureaucratic alarm bells.
Which is one reason why I'm thinking it's just sort of a misunderstanding along the way, or just so new and different that it takes some time. But as an example of that, I actually end the conversation with one question. I say to them, you know, many listeners were surprised to hear Adnan say in Serial that though this was not the life he expected to have, that he is leading a full life in prison. And I think for a lot of people listening on the outside, that was, you know, very surprising. And prison is this blind spot. We know nothing about what happens inside prison and who prisoners are. So I asked the guys, can you share something about your life in prison? And I guarantee you, what they say is not what anyone expects to hear about life in an American prison. They talk about meaningful, productive, connected lives that to a great extent are focused on serving others. And it doesn't do any good at all for me to be the person saying this. You know, you just have to hear it. And for me, it's just heartbreaking that you can't. And honestly, this is ODRC's stated mission. And it's a mission that's so necessary for our world. We don't have to agree with these guys. We don't have to like them. In no way do we erase whatever it is they've done, not at all. But we cannot treat 2 million people like one kind of person, tack a one-word label on them, and throw them away.
And I think this is a telling indication of what the state of our system currently is. The ODRC is leaps and bounds beyond what most prisons offer. So if even a prison like this is making it difficult just to have a relatively innocuous conversation with the prisoners aired on a podcast, you can only imagine how few opportunities there are in the rest of the United States to actually talk to prisoners and hear their stories.
You know, I was going to, Kendra, you talked a little bit about when you were explaining why we didn't get the rest of the audio. I mean, we did get part of the audio, which means there was almost like a some kind of qualitative call here, right? Like that this part of the content is okay, but then maybe this has something to do with the guidelines. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about those guidelines, because I'm curious myself, you know, does the First Amendment stop at a prison door? I know with Adnan, he was transferred to a supermax facility. I think it's been 6 or 7 years now, and it was not related to his own conduct. The prison he was at was, I think, a medium security, and it was really lax in many ways, but it was overcrowded, and there was apparently corruption. They shut it down. They took all of the lifers and put them in Supermax, and things have been much, much harder for him there. There's much less access. Certainly media can't. I mean, we've had so many requests for somebody from media to go interview him in person, you know, on video. And apparently the state of Maryland has never, ever allowed that for somebody in Supermax. Mm-hmm. So if you could talk a little bit about the guidelines at this particular institution, that'd be interesting.
Well, so that's a little bit different. What I'm doing is a little different than maybe media going in to talk about a particular newsworthy story. I mean, my project is really to understand, you know, what is happening inside this prison. And to do that, you know, I go there. I have a very free access. You know, I have conversations. I talk to people. And for me, when I before I publish anything, I run it by someone at the prison. And usually for me, the guidelines are about names, you know, just this identities to protect identities, either the prisoners or protect victims, you know, so they're not unexpectedly reading about a crime that involved them or their family. it's a little different than going in and like asking for a particular interview about a particular prisoner in a particular case. But, you know, Maryland and Ohio are just, I mean, every state has their own way of doing things. And I mean, one thing about Ohio, Adnan would not be in a max prison if he were incarcerated in Ohio. One thing it does is it looks at a prisoner, looks at who they are now. So you can move down.
I mean, that sounds like a system that is interested in rehabilitation and not retribution. But yeah, for someone like Adnan who was 17, and it wasn't just that he had a life sentence, but it was the additional 30 years on top of the life that has really limited him in terms of access to programs and stuff. He's pretty much, I think a number of years ago, he maxed out the kinds of programs he can do. So at this point, if he were to stay incarcerated for the rest of his life, he would have very little access to any other kind of educational program.
Right, which is why the kind of work that Healing Broken Circles is doing, you know, it's just so different. There's always new programming, and anybody can be involved in it, and you can continue to be involved in it.
Obviously, there are very good reasons for prisons to restrict prisoners' ability to communicate with certain people or sources, and I'm not disputing that at all. But at the same time, the fact that prisons can exercise such total control over prisoners' ability to communicate, and combined with the very arbitrary rules they employ in deciding when it's okay to talk and when it's not, it's a really powerful mechanism that the state has to prevent any of its problems, injustices, false convictions, or even just prisoner abuses from being uncovered. And I think we've been shown the power and the importance of not just legal strategies, but also public awareness strategies in dealing with false conviction cases or prisoner abuse cases. And I mean, look at Serial. Obviously, it's been hugely important for Adnan's case. I know we wouldn't be where we are today if it wasn't for that. But at the same time, the prison had the power, well, or at least had the ability to punish Adnan for violating the rule, that he couldn't make a show like that. And again, that's just the prison with its arbitrary rules, not wanting prisoners to do things that could apparently cause some kind of strife to the state.
Yeah, I think definitely if the state or the institution itself, Cumberland, had become aware that this is a reporter who is recording conversations early on, then we might not have even gotten a Serial in the way we got it. It really came towards the end of the podcast itself, because I think it was in the last few weeks of the actual show when it was running that somebody realized, oh, this is a guy at our facility who has been recorded. And Sarah wasn't done talking to him, obviously. She was still talking to him. So that did impact Adnan. They took away his phone privileges for about a month. And, you know, it's hard because it's not just about Sarah. Obviously, he couldn't communicate with his family. But, you know, one thing Adnan has always said in all these years, and because, you know, his exposure to other people in the system has taught him that he's actually really blessed and lucky in many ways, because he has a family and they check on him and they, you know, provide support for him. And he has some friends who, you know, still on the outside who have remained supportive over the last 16 years. But the most, many, many, many people who are incarcerated don't have that. They have, they really get forgotten in the system, and they don't have people who remember them, and they don't have people to call. They don't have people to visit. And most of them certainly don't have somebody who's like a public advocate in the way I've been, and then, you know, this whole entire team of people who's grown up around the case. And if anything, the public should really be aware of how much and how many people and how many resources it's taking just to kind of unravel Adnan's case, and how very few people are ever going to have that opportunity.
Yeah, when the state has the power to lock someone up and throw away the key, they can basically make it seem as if any kind of injustice never happened in the first place. I mean, Richard Glossop is another example of this. If he didn't have the network he has and didn't have the advocates he has, he'd be dead by now, for one, and his story would never have been noticed. The fact that there was something deeply troubling about his conviction never would have come out, and he'd have been executed with probably little or no fanfare. And in terms of his actual case, just look at the fact that what it's taken in order to find the new evidence of innocence coming out. For instance, one of Sneed, the alleged co-conspirator who actually did the killing and testified against Glossop in order to save his own life, one of Sneed's cellmates came forward to say, well, he talked to me about it and his stories don't match what he said at trial. That guy only came forward because he saw Glossop's story on Dr. Phil and thought, well, I have to say something now or I won't be okay with myself. And if it hadn't been for the publicity, if it hadn't been for Dr. Phil, that guy never would have known how important his story was.
That brings up one thing I remember the guy saying was that no one has come forth to say anything about Adnan. You know, you haven't heard. I remember one of them said, you know, they were amazed that he had no tickets, no citations, you know, except for the cell phone. And even if guards and COs don't know everything that's going on, other prisoners do. You can't hide violence, one of them said. And no prisoner has come forth to say, oh, you know, I know the true Adnan or something. You know, no one has. They were speaking about, you know, his sort of behavior in prison and that it was even more believable that because nobody has countered it, you know, and they could, certainly.
Well, at the same time, we talk about how hard it is to get access to prisoners, to have interviews. The state did let Sneed have an interview with a reporter because he was going to affirm their case. So it's that arbitrary power to decide what messages get out that's really problematic for me.
Right. I mean, that capriciousness, that arbitrariness, I mean, that's built into our criminal justice system, mm-hmm. probably at all levels, you know, and we need to address that. But I'd also like to make the point, and this is not at all to excuse the, you know, policies of the prisons, but, you know, terms like mass incarceration and the prison industrial complex, they may be ubiquitous today, but it has only recently become part of our cultural lexicon. I mean, the problem of mass incarceration has existed for decades. You know, I recently saw a graph of the use of the term mass incarceration. It was a LexisNexis search, so it would be the use of that term in our media, and it's flatlined. You know, it's like 000. Up until about 2006, it has the slightest little blip, you know, in 2012, a little more. And then it shoots real, you know, it shoots super high up, you know, in 2014. So the media and the American public in general have been quite happy with the system, or at least very quiet about it for a long time. And so these systems have been in place all along, and the system will keep rolling. I mean, it's only now that the public is asking, hopefully beginning to ask for something different. It's only now that we're paying attention. So this system is set in place. They've been able to do what they've been doing for a very long time without anyone caring. You know, so
there's a very similar trend, almost identical really in terms of time and extent in wrongful convictions and exonerations and how dramatically they've increased in the past few years.
Yeah.
And I think for both of those things, the increased public awareness is very much correlated with the rise of the tech and information age. These stories can get out now. There's obviously still very severe filters. But before, no one would have heard anything about any of this. And now there is a way, however convoluted, for the public to become aware of what's going on.
So prisons, you know, need to understand the social media thing, and they need to understand, you know, where the public feeling is headed, you know,
an administration, an institution like that, you're talking about sometimes, you know, people who've been doing this for decades too, very senior people. And I don't think they're going to necessarily grasp the power of social media. And all of this to me is certainly linked to smartphones, to citizen journalism, to Black Lives Matter movement, which has cracked the door open on the entire system. And I think it's going to continue. The momentum is going to continue. And I think we're going to see the impact is in grassroots movements for prison reform on a state level. And now, you know, we have the President of the United States talking about federal prison reform, too. So mm-hmm. There is a momentum now that I think will force the system to shift only because, and, you know, you said that the public was happy. The public just didn't know. I think that's what the truth is. The public didn't know. Now that the public knows what's happening in our own country, in our own backyards, I don't think the system can stay the way it is.
I do want to make the point, too, that, and I think I made this earlier, that it is the public fervor for punishment that also.
Yeah, that's true.
That prisons have to be concerned about because, you know, Marion, ODRC, has actually, you know, harnessed social media. I mean, it has prisoners on YouTube. Its prisoners are on YouTube. Its prisoners have been seen in public. And there will be people who complain about this. And they have to be aware of, I'm sure that's what they think, what criticism is going to come in, you know, because we're doing this, because we're doing something that's not been done and that people don't expect. I mean, my experience has just been so different. I mean, I've published stories about Marion Correctional. You know, my interest, of course, is about how the whole system works. And I'm not there to look into a particular case or to dig dirt. But I haven't felt that my access is restricted, and I've never had anything redacted. The guys in this conversation about serial undisclosed, they're self-selected. They are not handpicked by the institution. I'm sure the men that President Obama is talking to are handpicked by the institution. These guys are coming because they're interested. They listen to the podcast. They're interested. They want to be a part of a conversation. You know, and I worked on a project once where a currently incarcerated woman at Ohio Reformatory for Women not only attended but spoke at a public TEDx Columbus event in downtown Columbus. And if it's not obvious, we have a pretty thriving TED community here in Columbus and the Central Ohio. And I should probably disclose that I do some blogging for them. But at this event, you know, I was talking to the warden, and she asked if she could have extra tickets so she could bring along some other incarcerated women to be in the audience, you know, so they could benefit from the experience and help their, you know, fellow inmate on the stage and support her. And then the woman, Gabrielle, shared an important story. All the women had a meaningful experience that connected them to a wider community. An audience of 600 people now sees this walled-away place on the outskirts of town with completely different eyes. I mean, this is what a prison has done. You know, this is ODRC approved, and it was an amazing event. So clearly, you know, I mean, my experience has been so different.
I think a good example of the other end of the scale comes from Louisiana, where death row prisoners are not allowed to talk to anyone other than their own family. There's a man currently in death row there, Rodriguez Crawford, who was convicted of killing his son, with the only evidence against him being a disputed autopsy report, with one forensic pathologist testifying that it was homicide and other pathologists disagreeing with that. And that's the evidence that he's away for. And there's been a reporter looking into his story, looking into the case, and more so the prosecutor, who is very, very pro-death penalty and very pro-revenge, in his own words. And she tried to arrange a conversation with him indirectly by being at his mother's house when he called home so that she could talk to him. Of course, the prison can hear any conversations that the prisoners have, so they knew about that ahead of time and just prevented him from calling whenever the reporter was there with his family. So in that way, they can totally restrict their prisoner's ability to do what Anand's done, which is, you know, have his voice heard. Mm-hmm. Just seeing how important the public awareness side of these cases is, the prison's power to completely cut that off is something that should be reexamined.
Agreed.
And, you know, let me add to that, that in those instances, the only recourse an incarcerated person has is to have like really, really good, competent legal counsel, right? If you don't have a public voice, then all you can hope for is maybe a really good attorney who can do something in your case. And that's an extremely expensive, difficult proposition that very few people can afford. So in effect, you're at a dead end.
Yeah, most people many people are doing the law work themselves. I mean, you know, many prisoners become quite educated about the legal system.
Some aren't bad. I've read their motions. They're not always what you'd expect.
Yeah.
Yeah. Adnan's filed, I think, a couple of his pleadings himself, and he has joked a number of times with me when we talk, he'll argue. He'll be like, listen, I'm a lawyer too. And I said, okay, that's fine.
I've read his. Should I comment on
that? Yeah, you can.
I will say his are more typical.
You can hopefully mentor him when he gets on the outside.
You know, but sometimes it it just takes, I don't know, one person with some good sense to just avert the system from just rolling as it's been able to roll along for so long. I mean, like in Ohio, there's a former attorney general, Jim Petro. He is a former attorney general who, upon retirement, does pro bono work for the Ohio Innocence Project, which is interesting in itself. But there was a case of a person, Clarence Elkins, incarcerated. There was DNA evidence that found that connected someone else to the crime, but then the court and prosecutor denied his appeal. From what I heard from the guys inside who served with him, the reasoning was he wasn't convicted on DNA evidence, so he couldn't be exonerated on DNA evidence. But Jim Petro, an attorney general, I think the Innocence Project kind of pushed him to look at this a little bit, and it probably helped that Clarence Elkins is a, you know, family man, white, with no prior history of any criminal activity. He looked into it and said, just kind of, this is ridiculous. Of course we should, you know, reexamine this case. And Clarence Elkins would probably still be in prison if not one person just sort of stopped that system from just rolling and just said, yeah, hold on, you know, let's take this seriously. My point is not that it's going to be individuals that change the system. My point is just the system is just so big and so in motion, we just need to start putting, you know, stops in the system.
And that's what the media is in many cases, they're supposed to be.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
That level of injustice can go on without someone going, hey, wait, this is not right, because it's shielded from public eyes.
Right. And now the media is more likely to actually tell these stories because now the people seem to care, because the media, of course, is its own system that rolls along in its own way. And now that there is public awareness, then hopefully the media will be even more involved.
So, you know, we've talked at length now about systematic issues, but I am also curious about the men's reactions to some very particular things in Adnan's case, specifically actually Jay. I would love to get their read on Jay and what they think. You know, the question comes up a lot, like what was Jay's motive to lie? Why would he help the state? Like, why would he even take a role in any of this? And, you know, I have my theories, but I believe that they would probably have a perspective that's unique on that.
Well, I can say that, you know, each of them had different thoughts. I would say there was that has changed as they've learned more information. I remember at the end of my first conversation with them back in April, when they'd only heard Serial, that was a huge question. They couldn't figure out his motivation. I mean, they had various theories, like it's the biggest thing happening, he's got to be in on it. That, you know, it's a sort of prisoner's dilemma, sort of, that they were both, you know, it was going to be Adnan or him. You know, they talked about him being kind of a familiar, you know, personality. Like one guy said, you know, I was a black guy in the 90s listening to Rage Against the Machine, too. There seemed to be both this sort of interest, appeal, and the opposite. There was this little jokey conversation about whether or not they were Jay haters or not. You know, I think that mostly they were unable to figure out any kind of motivation. And it didn't make sense to lie, you know, if he already had a plea deal. Then after Undisclosed, and they only, this conversation happened after episode 8. So I gave them like a 30-second rundown of Crime Stoppers, the theory about Jay being the tipster. But, you know, before they heard episode 9 and 10, the deals with Jay and Crime Stoppers, they were starting to feel sorry for him, I would say, which didn't come out after Serial so much, that he just was put in a difficult position. Some people said that. I think he's a conundrum to them as well. They did talk about, you know, how people don't realize that in an interrogation room, they can say, police are able to say anything they want to you. They can lie to you. So I think they sympathize with him being in that position. And they're also sort of amazed that Adnan was in the same position and nothing came of it. That's one of them said, that's just highly unusual. Usually if you have some involvement, you start to try and lie to cover up for it, and you end up telling truths you didn't mean to tell. So the fact that nothing came out of Adnan's interrogation was telling for them. You know, I think they're as confused about Jay as everyone. You know, they were not confused about why he knew about the location of Hay's car at all. Basically, they said, you know, that's an easy one. Like, you're a dope boy in the neighborhood. Come on, you guys. You know, this is what they're saying to each other. You know, if you're the dope boy in your neighborhood, you know where everything is in your neighborhood. You've seen Hay's car. You know where it is. That was a no big deal for them. Right. The Nisha call was also no big deal for them. Like, the two things that hung up a lot of people on Serial just were easily explained.
So, Kendra, you've been doing all this on your own time, your own money, and putting in a lot of work just for this podcast alone. Can you tell us why you do this? Why are you in the prison? Why are you talking to them?
Yeah. You know, it's not a controversial thing to say that our criminal justice system has the capacity to be cruel and highly capricious. And once you see that in terms of real people, you just can't look away. But I'm not a martyr, really. I do it because I get so much more than I give. I have the best conversations in prison. A very remarkable person once told me, Marion Correctional is where questions go to multiply. And it is fascinating and challenging. And for me, I feel like my heart and my smarts just get a little upgrade every time I go. It's not that I become a more trusting or less skeptical person. It's just that whole trust system is fine-tuned and smarter. It's not as knee-jerk as it used to be. Those assumptions and fears that are behind the scenes kind of running our show as human beings, I feel like they just have a little less control over me. So, you know, there's an odd thing to say. Prison has made me feel more free. And another thing, and that's also probably just not going to compute for most people, prison is an oddly hopeful place. It's really amazing to witness people like in great adversity not only survive but thrive and turn around and help others. And to be clear, when I say adversity in prison, you know, it's not just about being imprisoned. That adversity is everything they may have experienced or believed about themselves long before they ever got to prison, or that adversity is their crime. I mean, for those who've really caused harm, every day they have to figure out how to live with what they've done, even if it's been 20, 30 years. Your personal growth, self-understanding, self-efficacy is something a lot of people on the outside, we struggle with. You know, there's a whole self-help industry built around it. And there are people in prison who have gotten there or are getting there and, you know, are driven to help other people. You know, not everyone, but they are there. There is no everyone. I mean, that's my main point, is there's 2 million different ones, you know, and we can't treat them as one thing. And, you know, that's one thing I've seen. You know, it's an amazing thing to witness and learn from. And that's why I do what I do.
Now, I've done a bit of work with law enforcement and correctional facilities through a firm that I founded a few years ago called the Safe Nation Collaborative, which you can find online if you're curious. But what I learned was that there is very little cohesion in policies when it comes to different prisons. Each prison operates like its own little island, and the culture at each facility is very much dictated by the people running it, which can be a challenge when you're trying to make systematic changes, but it's also an opportunity, because it means just one or two people can make a tremendous difference. I have to say how impressed I am with the culture and framework of Marion Correctional. It is an excellent model for how correctional institutions should operate and how incarcerated people should be treated. For people wondering about Adnan's prison conditions, well, for many years, he was incarcerated at the Maryland House of Corrections in Jessup, Maryland, which was a notoriously violent and dangerous prison. But a prison that was incredibly lax, and that was probably due to a tremendous amount of institutional corruption. So in 2007, in total secrecy,
Officials transferred over 800 people from Jessup to other prisons in the state, and they shut it down. Those who were serving life sentences were moved to not just a maximum security prison, but a state-of-the-art supermax. It's called the North Branch Correctional Institute in Cumberland, Maryland, and you can actually find documentaries about it on YouTube. It was a really tough move on everyone, because whereas Adnan was originally about 20 minutes away from his parents' house, we could easily see him. They could easily see him once a week, if not more often. But now he's about 3 hours away. And if you drive there and you arrive a few minutes late, you can't see him. If you get there and suddenly the prison's on lockdown because of a recent incident, you can't see him. Either way, it will take your entire day to come and go. And for Adnan and the other men who were transferred there, it has severely cut their access to programs and education. I'd like to thank the guys at Marion who volunteered to take part in this podcast and share their thoughts with us and their stories with us, and Kendra Hovey for all her work in putting this together. Special thanks also goes to Jason Bunting, the warden of Marion Correctional, for all of his support. I'd also like to thank Healing Broken Circles. They are doing amazing things on a small budget, and all ad proceeds from this episode will be donated to them. As Kendra put it to me, you always hear about what's wrong with prisons, but that makes it all the more important to pay attention to what's working, understand it, support it, and start scaling it. Kendra is hoping to continue her work through Healing Broken Circles by creating a podcast in which the prisoners can discuss their lives and experiences. If you'd like to support her work, you can donate to Healing Broken Circles online through the Columbus Foundation or through a link on our website. Lastly, I'd like to thank the Ohio Department of Rehabilitation and Corrections for their support for this project. And if they change their mind about releasing the second half of the prisoner's conversation, let us know. We'd still love to play it. Now, next week, we return to Adnan's case. Next week is also when Adnan's attorney files his response to the state, after which the court will issue a ruling. Between what Adnan's attorney will be filing, what Bob from Serial Dynasty will be revealing in his next episode, and what we'll be bringing to you over the next few weeks, prepare to have your mind blown. Many thanks to Christy Williams, who designed and maintains our website, to Baluki, who designed our logo, to Ramiro Marquez for our theme music and photography, to Patrick Cortez for his original music, to our editor Amar Naji, and our production consultant Rebecca Lavoie, who is a true crime author and the host of Crime Writers on Serial podcast. Dennis Robinson is our executive producer, and you can find us on social media on both Facebook and Twitter. Our Twitter handle is @undisclosedpod. Tweet us your comments, your suggestions, and your questions, and in a future episode, we'll try to respond to them. Thanks for listening.
The Undisclosed Podcast is brought to you in part by the Adnan Syed Trust, a legal defense fund that helps to pay Adnan's legal fees and associated investigative efforts. All proceeds raised through advertising on today's episode of Undisclosed were given to the trust. To learn more about the trust and to donate to our efforts to free Adnan, please visit www.launchgood.com/freeAdnan.